My name is David Wee. I'm an English professor at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. And my family and I arrived here about 10 days ago and will be here for 4 months. I'm on my sabbatical leave from my college teaching. And I'll be on the faculty with responsibility for leading discussions about literature. I've had several sessions on literature so far, and perhaps a few of you have been at some of those. One thing that I would like to achieve during the 45 minutes or so that we have is to talk about two particular poems and the ways in which poets express themselves, the kinds of techniques that poets will use to make certain perceptions. And I chose two poems that to me are very interesting and have a common subject, and that is the experience of the end of a love affair, the breaking up of relationship between two people who loved one another. I'll read, and we'll give our attention first of all to the first poem. I'll read it and then we'll discuss it a little bit. Since there's no help, come, let us kiss and part. Nay, I have done, you get no more of me. And I am glad, yea, glad with all my heart, that thus so cleanly I myself can free. Shake hands forever, cancel all our vows. And when we meet at any time again, be it not seen in either of our brows that we one jot of former love retain. Now at the last gasp of love's latest breath, when his pulse failing, passion's speechless lies, when faith is kneeling by his bed of death and innocence is closing up his eyes, now if thou wouldst, when all have given him over, from death to life, thou mightst him yet recover. Now you can see by the dates of the author, Michael Drayton, that this is a Renaissance poem. And some of you may have recognized it as a sonnet. And I'll say a couple things about the sonnet as a form. My wife Karen talked the other night about a little about the sonnet and what it does to a poet's imagination. There are certain forms of art and of literature in any language, in any culture, which are accepted in traditional and largely unchangeable forms. And the sonnet in English is one of the most familiar ones. A sonnet always has 14 lines. It's always in iambic pentameter, which means that it has 10 syllables and 5 what we call poetic feet. And that's a stressed syllable and an unstressed syllable. So a sonnet in English has the rhythm da-dum, 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 da-dum. That 5 of those stressed feet per line, and then 14 lines and certain rhyme patterns, certain rhyme scheme. Now I put here on the board just a simple illustration of what the two major kinds of sonnets in the English language are. The one is called the Elizabethan or Shakespearean sonnet, named after Shakespeare because he was so good at it. And it's the one on the left here. We've got our 14 lines, but it has 3 4-line sections and then a 2-line section at the end. We call those 4-line sections quatrains. So we have 3 quatrains and then a rhymed couplet. And the way it works is that the poet usually organizes the poem according to this structure. And I think that on Friday, when a couple of us are talking about poetry, about the aging, I'll have a sonnet that we could look at which uses this exact structure. There's a certain rhyme scheme. In each of these quatrains, the first and the third lines rhyme, and the second and the fourth lines rhyme, just as a common stanza form in English. So that's the Shakespearean sonnet. This is called the Petrarchan or the Italian sonnet because it was popularized by Petrarch, who was doing these in Italian. But many writers of English chose this form as well. And it has just two major parts. The first part has 8 lines, and the second part has 6 lines. And there are only 2 rhymes in all of the first 8 lines. That is, the first and the fourth and the fifth and eighth lines all have the same rhyme sound at the end. And the second and third lines and the sixth and seventh lines rhyme with each other. So they're just 2 different rhyming sounds. Lines 1, 4, 5, and 8 have the same rhyme sound, and 2, 3, 6, and 7 rhyme together. And then the sestet has 3 rhyming sounds. 2 of those lines rhyme with each other, 2 more rhyme with each other, and the other 2 rhyme with each other. But they can be mixed up in any way the poet chooses. Now this is a kind of modified version of this second way of doing a sonnet. And we'll look at the way in which the poet has used the form in order to organize the things that he wants to say. First of all, we talked about this once before in a poetry session. When we try to come to grips with the poem, we need to ask a few questions right at the outset. One is, can we identify the speaker? Now, we should not always identify the speaker and the poet. That is, often a poet will create an imaginary person who is speaking the words that we read. And Michael Drayton may never have had any experience whatsoever like this, but chose to create an imaginary person who says these lines. For instance, you might have a young male poet writing a poem in which he is expressing the words of an old female person. It's perfectly legitimate, but it would be a mistake for us to say these are the thoughts or the words of the poet. So always remember that possibly the words are not those of the poet, but of some created person. Well, do we have any sense in this poem who the speaker is? Do we know anything at all about the speaker? Oh, I'm sorry. Here. Is there anyone else who needs one sheet? Okay. Do you know if the speaker is male or female, for instance?
Female.
Female speaker? Okay. How do you know it's a female speaker?
We thought it was male.
You thought it was a male speaker. Okay, how do you know?
Purely feeling.
You just sensed it was, you sensed it was male, and some of you sensed it was female. The time in which it was written?
Yeah.
And what would that have to do with?
I
mean that a woman wouldn't have spoken these kinds of things?
Yes.
Okay. Any other thoughts about the gender of our speaker? Well, we can hold
would
that off.
Would the woman have had the power to break it off?
Pardon?
Would the woman have had the power to break it off in those days?
Okay. Perhaps a woman, the role of women in relationship to men might have been such that a woman couldn't have taken the initiative to break it off. Okay.
Love, capital L.
Okay, and how do you know that love is male?
Well, pronouns plural.
Right, it's the masculine pronouns, his, several times down there.
But his innocence
okay.
Male.
Okay.
Yeah, all of them are.
They all are. All three of
his.
They're all three of them.
Okay, well, we'll hold that question about the gender of the speaker for a moment.
My wife is going to allow male to be passionate.
Okay. Now, do we know whether there's a listener? That's another thing we need to ask when there's a speaker in a poem. Is there a situation in which the speaker is speaking directly to a listener, or is it just thoughts that are being expressed, perhaps to no one? Do you have a sense for that?
Sounds like thoughts to me.
Okay, that this might just
be a marvelous dramatic reading that somebody was giving to the lover, to the lover.
Okay. You see a little dramatic situation here.
Oh,
in other words, you're visualizing.
No help. Come, let us kiss and part. Nay, I have done. You get no more of me. Like they were reaching out for one more passionate embrace or something.
Okay, so you see that the other lover, the other member of this couple, is there being addressed in the poem. Okay, any other thoughts?
To me, it almost seems like this is what the lovers go and find, what they would say, and then at the end, the capitulation, or the realization that they're fooling themselves, I'm thinking of it. So it seems like a reflective kind of,
okay.
Something you imagine you'd say to somebody.
Okay, you see by the end of the poem that there's reflection on it that reveals more than the words at the start, is that? That there's some change? Okay. Any other thoughts about
it? The biggest confusion for me is the pronoun in the next to the last line, the him.
Okay.
That's the biggest ambivalent thing
right.
in the whole thing for me. Because the his eyes go with innocence, there's no doubt. But does him still refer back to innocence in the next two lines, the last two lines?
That is a puzzle here. Those pronouns are difficult to attach to the word they refer to. And that's a kind of care we have to take with this every poem to make sure that we're hooking up the pronouns with the right term in advance.
If his is all related to love, there's no problem.
Right. If him refers to love, then we could...
Innocence is closing the eyes of love, yeah, all the way along.
Okay.
There's no problem.
Okay. Well, we'll get at that section there at the end shortly. Just want to make sure that we have an image of what's happening now. All right, let's assume that the two lovers are addressing one another, and one is speaking to the other. What happens? What's the kind of tone, or what action do you visualize happening? Is there weeping and sadness? And can you tell how that... Is there anything in the lines different from my tone of voice that conveys that anger?
I'm thus so clean am myself and free. I mean, that's tearing things from yourself, you know.
Okay, there's seems to be a kind of grim satisfaction in a neat, clean breaking off of the relationship. How would you characterize the tone? The tone of voice of the beginning of this poem, the first half of it.
Resignation.
Okay.
Kind of futility in a way. There's nothing else.
Okay, it is. It certainly is futility. It seems to be no chance.
And whatever is going between them, they don't want to let anybody know in public what has previously gone on between them.
That's right.
On the street, you know, with no expression whatsoever.
That's right.
It's gone, so that others don't know.
Okay, good. The speaker
it's
wants
very private.
Let's say, let's not give any evidence later on that we ever loved each other.
Is that necessarily for the public, though? That might be, don't you try to rekindle this flame.
Okay, well, what he says is, be it not seen in either of our brows.
By either of us.
It could be by either of us.
Yeah.
Well, now, look at the language. I wondered if you noticed anything odd about the language in this poem. Some of you have hinted at it already.
Well, the word jot.
Okay.
That means little or just minute.
Okay. And that's a kind of informal or colloquial
mm-hmm.
term, isn't it?
But look at the date, that's
right. Yeah. Imagine that you were the lover who's speaking here, and that you were addressing these lines to the other. Do the lines sound convincing all the way through? Don't you see the great shift in tone of voice and in language between line 8 and 9? Look at what happens right at this point where a sonnet usually breaks into its two sections. You have in the first 8 lines extremely informal, colloquial, and rapidly spoken relief, sense of futility. In the conversation here. Since there's no help, come let us kiss and part. Nay, I have done, you get no more of me, and I'm glad, yea, glad with all my heart. Notice how virtually all the words are one-syllable words. They're the kind of everyday spoken language of people in the streets. But look at what happens starting then at this break in the sonnet at line 9. Now at the last gasp of love's latest breath, when his pulse failing, passion speechless lies. Can you imagine anyone, yourself, either doing the speaking or being spoken to have someone saying, and if we meet at any time again, be it not seen in either of our brows that we one jot of former love retain. Now, at the last gasp of love's latest breath, when his pulse failing, passion speechless lies. There's a real shift, isn't there, even in the rhythms of it. There's heavy pauses in the line. And suddenly, what do we call this technique where we capitalize things which are abstract? Yeah, we have personification. And we're given this picture of love and passion and faith and innocence as human figures in a little scene happening here. Now, I find it very hard to believe that any lover would speak these 14 lines in succession to another person. It's just too complete a shift in the rhythm, in the vocabulary, in the formality, from informality to formality, for us to think of that this is realistically what anyone would do. So that forces us to ask, well, are all of these lines seen through the eyes? Are they all from the viewpoint of one speaker? And my theory about this, and some of my colleagues think I'm crazy, but I happen to think there are three different speakers in this poem. And that we don't really understand it unless we recognize that there are not just one person speaking all these lines, but three. And here, I think that one speaker speaks the first line. And then a second speaker speaks lines 2 through 8. And then a third voice comes in with the last 6 lines. Now here's why I think this. Notice what the first line says. Since there's no help, let's kiss. Well, what's the response to that? Nay, you get no more of me. It sounds to me like a rejection of what's being suggested in the first line. And what's offered is an alternative. Handshake, that's right. So you see, it looks to me like one person says, okay, it's all over, let's kiss. And the other one says, oh no, I know what happens when we start kissing. We'll shake hands. And end it that way. This is an alternative suggestion. And then this great relief expressed by the second person that it's neat, clean, finished, all done. But then comes this strangely formal voice and all of this personification and the picture of love and passion lying on the deathbed. And what is being said in those last 6 lines? And Marilyn, you really mentioned this earlier on. What view do we get in the end?
That all this talk is really, it means nothing because love can spring back to life even if it appears dead.
What's being said there in the last 6 lines and in that personification of those of love and passion on the deathbed, which is a good image for the end of the affair, is that there's still hope. There is some help in contrast to what the first speaker said in the first line. That while love may appear to be dead, love isn't dead yet. The other, it's on the deathbed, things look grim, but there's still a chance.
Is that your third speaker then?
Yeah, this strikes me as not. Okay, who would that be? If maybe you aren't willing to buy this interpretation, but if
the equivalent of the Greek chorus.
All right, it's similar to the Greek chorus, which makes comments on what's happening amongst the actors on the stage. Kind of gives a more universal or cosmic view. I think that that's the sort of thing that's going on here. That here is the perception of someone who's not one of the two lovers, call it a divine or a cosmic or a universal wisdom that says, look, even when two lovers are breaking up with the apparent finality and the apparent relief that these two are breaking up, still it's not necessarily all over. And then we see that in the last two lines, if thou wouldst, that means if you really want to, when all have given him over, that is when all people involved have given up on love and passion, or love or passion. It seems to me the hymn refers back to, it's both love and passion that are dying here, and it refers to both. From death to life, thou mightst him yet recover. It's still possible for a deathbed resuscitation and love and passion will survive.
Because of the date of it, another thing comes into my mind, and that is, in many of Shakespeare's plays, you have a soliloquy after a dramatic action in which the relatively minor partner interprets it for us, for the death of Romeo
That's
and
right.
Juliet and for others. And we get some idea, if only they hadn't had this, or if they corrected this.
That's right.
Sort of thing. Maybe that's a better analogy than the Greek chorus.
Well, it's a good one, because we have an interpretation here. We have somebody, some voice, that's able to say, look, in spite of what you're seeing here in this breaking up, that kind of glibness and the finality that's expressed by the speaker is really a cover-up. In other words, this is a psychological poem. It's telling us what we are really like, that even when there's a little bit of that love in us, we think that we can end it by being quick and glib and thorough and positive in the way in which the speaker says, you know, we're going to be able to diminish any evidence that we've ever loved one another. Another clue to what's happening here is, look at the formal language of those last two lines. If thou wouldst. Notice that back in the second line, the speaker says, you get. It's not thou getst. There's been a shift from informal and colloquial in the first part to this very formal, if thou wouldst. I can't imagine that any one of us in 30 seconds of speech would make that kind of shift to a loved one. So that's another reason that I believe we've got another voice here, that chorus or that interpretive speaker who's saying, look at this couple thinking that it's easy to break things off, and yet if either of them really wanted to, they could revive this love affair. And I suspect that the person who speaks the first line, if that is a different person from the one who speaks lines 2 through 8, understands this and says, let's kiss. And the second lover says, oh no, you don't get anything anymore of me, we're going to shake hands and cancel it all. It's really two distinctly different ways of terminating it. Well, I think that on a first reading of this poem, we don't see all those things. You know, if we're careless, or on a first reading, even if we're careful on a first reading, you don't notice things like the change in the formality of language from the informal to the formal. The shift from a kind of quick rhythm in the first 8 lines to those heavy pauses in the personification of the last 6 lines. And the shift from the you get to thou wouldst, the very formal tone in the last 2 lines. And that's the sort of thing we need to be alert to when you read a poem if we want to come to grips with what's really happening. Because one could say this is a bad poem if we were to believe that one person, one of the two lovers, says all these lines to the other. Because we just don't shift our tone of voice in a situation like this that completely. But if we look at it more carefully, realize how the poet has taken a traditional structure and shaped it in a certain way, we have a better chance of seeing what's going on in the poem, and that those final six lines are not one of the lovers speaking, but that chorus-like voice, which is making a comment, helping us understand the real psychology of what happens to human beings in a situation like that. Well, let's look at the other one by a more recent writer, Thomas Hardy. Most of us know Hardy as a novelist and have read things like The Return of the Native or Tess of the D'Urbervilles. Hardy quit writing novels in 1894. He had written novels for 25 years, and his last one, Jude the Obscure, published in 1894, met with such outrage on the part of the British people. It was burned publicly, and bishops condemned it from the pulpit and so forth, that Hardy gave up in despair and turned to writing poetry the rest of his life. And most of us, unfortunately, don't know his poetry as well as we know some of his fiction. Neutral Tones. We stood by a pond that winter day, and the sun was white, as though chidden of God, and a few leaves lay on the starving sod. They had fallen from an ash and were gray. Your eyes on me were as eyes that rove over tedious riddles of years ago, and some words played between us to and fro, on which lost the more by our love. The smile on your mouth was the deadest thing alive enough to have strength to die, and a grin of bitterness swept thereby like an ominous bird a wing. Since then, keen lessons that love deceives and rings with wrong have shaped to me your face and the God-cursed sun and a tree and a pond edged with grayish leaves. What kind of tone do you sense in this poem?
It's negative.
It's extremely negative, isn't it? It's entirely different from that kind of quick self-assurance of the opening lines of the first poem, isn't it?
Practically an elegy.
That's right. It's practically an elegy, a lament for the dead, or in this case, for a dead love. Do we know the speaker, anything about the speaker and a listener or a situation in this poem? Okay, been married a long time. Is one speaker speaking to the other? Is there a situation? As we had in the first one, obviously somebody was speaking nose to nose with the other lover at the start of the poem. Do we have that going on here? Not necessarily, do we? This could be that kind of poem that we call a lyric, where the words or the thoughts of the speaker are being expressed either out loud or silently, but without necessarily a listener. When this is done on the stage, we call it a soliloquy. But it's what we call lyric poetry, when someone is trying to express the thoughts or experiences or words of someone, but not necessarily in a little situation that we can see acted out or dramatized. What kinds of details does the speaker emphasize here? Neutral tones. There's a lot of things about color, isn't
gray.
There? Okay.
Edge.
Okay.
And white.
All right. Now what effect do these neutral tones have on our understanding and our response to the poem? Okay, what if in the second line with the reference to white, what if it said, and the snow is white?
Well, it always is, unless it's
right.
Dirty. The sun isn't very often white.
Okay, the reference to the sun as white, the sun usually is suggested as what color?
Yellow
or gold or orange, and we call those warm colors, don't we? They suggest heat and warmth, and that includes emotional or spiritual warmth as well as thermal. And what?
Sort of dying colors, aren't they?
That's right. They're colors that suggest a dying out or a death. The leaves are what color? Gray. They aren't green. They aren't even bright orange. They're just gray, which suggests absence of color, absence of brightness, and absence of warmth and light. What would be the difference if that fourth line said they had fallen from an oak and were gray? What would be lost?
Lose the symbolism of ashes. Of ashes.
Right. Ashes are not only gray and a good neutral tone to include, but ashes, as we have in front of us here, suggest death and something having been burned up or consumed. So you see, here the poet is using an image in a special way. Could have been any old tree that perhaps had gray bark and gray leaves, but he chose as the image an ash because of its suggestiveness about have something consumed and gone and nothing left over but ash. What about the sun being chidden of God? What does that mean?
Being scolded?
Yeah.
Representative of God, whiteness. I don't know.
Well, the thing that's white is the sun, so it doesn't refer to God acting on the sun. It's the it's what happens to the sun when God scolds the sun. Mm-hmm. The sun looks as if it had been scolded by God. What conception of the universe does that give us? It makes the whole setting seem extremely grim and depressed.
Well, does that come from derivation from the word chide, to scold?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the past tense of
right.
To chide.
Is that correct English? Chidden?
We don't very often use the word that way anymore. In fact, we don't use the word chide too much, but it is correct.
For points, you don't have to have correct English.
That's right. You can take some liberties with the language. But this one is correct. Right, look at the second stanza. And the other thing we could point out about another detail in that first stanza is the sod. What is it about the sod? It's starving. You know, again, absence of nourishment. And all of these details, you see, help reinforce the details about the relationship between the two speakers. What sense do you get from the second stanza?
Boredom.
Boredom. What gives us this sense of boredom?
Tedious riddles and years ago again.
Okay. What other words do it? Tedious riddles, years ago. To and fro. If you were really trying to describe a passionate verbal exchange between two lovers, would you say the words played back and forth or to and fro suggest a sort of ping-pong game monotony, you know, the to and fro and playing back and forth?
Yeah, but love games are often, I mean, you can play at love with the way you speak back and forth.
Okay, but do you think in this context it suggests anything positive about the exchange?
Yes, yeah.
The last line of this stanza is very difficult to understand because of a pronoun in there, on which. One of my students finally explained this to me, and I'm sure it's correct, because for years I hadn't figured this out. A paraphrase of the last two lines of that second stanza go, and some words pass back and forth between us on the subject of which one of us has been diminished more because we love each other. In other words, we're comparing notes on which one of us was the worst off because of our love for each other. You know, the exact opposite sort of thing that most lovers are discussing, mostly they're lovers are speaking about how much enriched they are by the love of the other. And here discussing the topic, which one of us lost the more by our love, by the fact that we're in love with each other.
The verb played is still odd there, though. He might have done better with a different verb. To explain the absence of anything better to say.
All right, sure. There would be other words that suggest a kind of empty, exchange. Because what? Limped. Okay. That would be a good one. Then the third stanza. What kind of effect do we get here? All right. The word bitterness in the third line here is a good one for describing the tone.
But also a phrase. There's a little scare in here with the word ominous.
Okay.
That sounds like a vulture.
That's right. There's an image of a vulture. It's not a little sparrow twitting back and forth in front of them. It's a ominous bird. And what does that suggest? What does the word ominous mean? There's a kind of root meaning of ominous.
Omen.
That's right. It provides an omen, which means a forewarning of something that's about to happen. Ominous bird makes us think of a vulture because vultures are around when there's going to be a death. And, of course, that's what's happening here. The grin on her face, the nature of that grin was an omen or a forewarning that the death of this relationship is imminent. So we have two extremely grim similes here. Your smile is the deadest thing alive enough to have strength to die. That's just a powerful phrase about terminal weakness.
Would there be some sarcasm in that?
Well, yeah, there is some sarcasm. There's harshness. You know, sarcasm comes from the Greek, from sarx, flesh, and sarkazo, which means to tear flesh like dogs. And so when one is being sarcastic, you're just tearing something apart. And the speaker here is being very harsh on what was happening to their relationship. Well, then we have a bit of reflection in the last stanza, don't we? Since then. Now, the first three stanzas have talked about what was going on at that particular pond on that day. And we have this great accumulation of depressing, emotionless images in the colors, the details announced, these similes about the grin and the nature of their conversation. Since then, keen lessons that love deceives and rings with wrong have shaped to me your face. Now, what's the speaker saying here? Let me paraphrase that.
It wasn't worth the trouble.
Many things have happened, many times. He's learned his lesson many times since then.
Okay, the speaker is letting us know that lots of time has passed since that day by the pond, and that since that time the speaker has had experiences that love deceives.
He's becoming philosophical there, I think, in the first part were his feelings about his love, and then he's thinking about how love is.
That's right. The speaker has concluded that love deceives, that when people are in love with each other, all sorts of blindness occurs, and that there's deceit that happens. But notice the speaker is saying that whenever I get one of these lessons, in other words, whenever I have another experience where I discover that love deceives, what happens?
I see you.
Right, I think of that day by the pond again. I was thinking about this morning when Professor Wolf was talking about symbolism, about reenactment of things, about the way in which certain acts cause us to think or reflect on certain things. Here's the reverse, where whenever a certain occurrence happens to the person, it brings that image into mind. Similar to the sort of thing that happens whenever suddenly in a crowded street you smell a certain perfume that you haven't smelled for 20 years, and immediately it brings to mind the face of that person who you last were with and smelled that perfume. You know, we have a kind of olfactory memory as well as other kinds. And here the speaker is saying, since that time, whenever I have another experience of deceit in love, I think of your face with that grin of bitterness, and the God-cursed sun, and a tree, and a pond edged with grayish leaves. So we see what is the way in which the human mind associates visual objects with emotional experiences. And I think if we think about it, we'd all be able to come up with situations in which various times in our lives, seeing something, smelling something, hearing something, suddenly brings to mind an earlier experience, or a present experience brings to mind an image of something that we experienced long ago. Notice the poet's choice even here, the alliteration in rings with wrong. The word rings suggests both the not only the wringing out of water from a cloth, let's say that kind of wrenching thing, but sound, you know, as the ringing of a death knell, let's say. The word works in a couple of ways. And keen lessons. What does the word keen suggest?
Keen?
Sharp.
Cutting, yeah. Knife. Pain. There's another meaning of the word keen.
Isn't that a sound that's made like a wail?
That's right. Keen is a kind of funeral wail. We usually associate it with the wailing at a funeral. So again, Hardy could have said sharp lessons that love deceives, but keen suggests more specifically, it's a term we use to describe the sharpness of a knife, and therefore the injury and cutting, and then the wailing at a funeral.
Sadness.
Yeah,
hurt.
That's right.
Yeah, this kind of affects me that way. It makes me ill.
Yeah. Well, then
because he's feeling so much here.
Then he's done a good job with the poem, and you've done a good job as a reader. Because sometimes we read good poems and we don't feel the pain. But when we look closely at what's happening here and realize that the poet is using these details of a setting, someone's face, the color of the sun, the pond, and how every time a certain emotional experience happens, that's what comes to mind, is an important psychological fact about all of us.
Is he being ironic with his title? Because the neutral...
Okay, what do you think?
Is neutral.
You think it should be more negative than that? It should be named black tones or...
Well, I think he's reached an understanding, so it can be neutral now. He's, in these last four lines, I think he's understood what's happened to him.
That's right.
And so he's in a neutral. He's ready for something new, maybe, you know?
That's right. And what we realized by the end is that at the time of the events in the first three stanza, the speaker didn't realize what was happening. It's only on reflection and having this experience happen over again that he or she, we can't tell if the speaker is a male or female, and we can't tell in the first poem for sure either, that the speaker remembers the first experience, the first time that happened. But now the speaker sees that that grin on the face was like an ominous bird. Probably wouldn't have said that at the time. Didn't, you know, was too inexperienced in love to know that this was a foreboding of the end of the affair. Just like the speaker in the early part of the first poem is naive enough to think that I can quickly break it off, you know, cut off my emotional ties like nothing. And Drayton is saying it doesn't happen that easily always. And the speaker here may not have perceived all of these things that first time, that winter day, but now as an experienced person in the ways of love, having been deceived, that first impression of that first time comes back. And it's simply the way in which poets work and the way in which human beings work. We take an image, a thing, a place, a smell, a sound, and we associate it with some experience that we've had. And that's why we have such a hard time with some poetry. We see the image, the experience, and we can't figure out what to relate it to. Similar to a thing like foot washing. That's an experience of touching a certain part of the body. We sometimes are totally confused about the meaning of it. For some of us, the significance of it is quite clear. For others, it's not, until some more understanding comes through other experiences. Umhang, do you have a question?
I had a question about a word you use frequently during both of these poems.
Okay.
Are you using the word affair in its popular 20th century meaning, or are you using it to mean any relationship between people?
Yeah, I just meant any relationship, not necessarily a kind of illicit thing.
Yeah, that's thing, I just wanted to clarify what the word meant.
Yeah, I just meant it as a love relationship.
This is stronger than an affair, I think. This reminds me I lost my husband by death. It's very difficult for me to put on a new relationship because I don't want to be hurt like that again.
That's right.
And this is what this poem expresses to me.
The way it works, I have a feeling that he's reminiscing through married life, that this could be Hardy talking about his own, you know, love for his wife, and reminiscing back through the years.
That's right.
I call it reminiscent tones or something like that.
Yeah.
But it uses the pronoun we. If he would be writing somebody else, he would say they stood by the pond.
Sorry,
I just have a feeling it could be him. It could have.
It could be. And Hardy certainly did have some unhappy love relationships and a couple of marriages. So this could be the kind of thing where even though Hardy may never have stood with one of his loved ones at a pond on a day like that, and therefore he created the situation in a speaker, the experience was similar to, or exactly, his own experience.